Bellamy had tried one last time and gotten through, speaking very briefly in hushed tones, and then hanging up. "Follow the conveyor to the end," Bellamy said, "and jump off quickly before you circle back. Use my keycard to get out."
"Get out of where?" Langdon demanded.
But Bellamy was already pulling levers. All the different conveyors in the room hummed to life. Langdon felt himself jolt into motion, and the ceiling began moving overhead.
"God save me."
As Langdon approached the opening in the wall, he looked back and saw Warren Bellamy race through the doorway into the stacks, closing the door behind him. An instant later, Langdon slid into the darkness, swallowed up by the library, just as a glowing red laser dot came dancing down the stairs. Chapter 60. The underpaid female security guard from Preferred Security double-checked the Colorama Heights address on her call sheet.
"This is it?"
The gated driveway before her belonged to one of the neighborhood's largest and quietest estates, and so it seemed odd that 911 had just received an urgent call about it. As usual with unconfirmed call-ins, 911 had contacted the local alarm company before bothering the police. The guard often thought the alarm company's motto, "Your first line of defense," could just as easily have been false alarms, pranks, lost pets, and complaints from wacky neighbors. Tonight, as usual, the guard had arrived with no details about the specific concern.
Above my pay grade.
Her job was simply to show up with her yellow bubble light spinning, assess the property, and report anything unusual. Normally, something innocuous had tripped the house alarm, and she would use her override keys to reset it. This house, however, was silent. No alarm. From the road, everything looked dark and peaceful. The guard buzzed the intercom at the gate, but got no answer. She typed her override code to open the gate and pulled into the driveway. Leaving her engine running and her bubble light spinning, she walked up to the front door and rang the bell. No answer. She saw no lights and no movement. Reluctantly, following procedure, she flicked on her flashlight to begin her trek around the house to check the doors and windows for signs of break-in. As she rounded the corner, a black stretch limousine drove past the house, slowing for a moment before continuing on.
Rubbernecking neighbors.
Bit by bit, she made her way around the house but saw nothing out of place. The house was bigger than she had imagined, and by the time she reached the backyard, she was shivering from the cold. Obviously, there was nobody home.
"Dispatch," she called in on her radio. "I'm on the Colorama Heights call. Owners aren't home. No signs of trouble. Finished the perimeter check. No indication of an intruder. False alarm."
"Roger that," the dispatcher replied. "Have a good night." The guard put her radio back on her belt and began retracing her steps, eager to get back to the warmth of her vehicle. As she did so, however, she spotted something she had missed earlier. A tiny speck of bluish light on the back of the house. Puzzled, she walked over to it, now seeing the source. A low transom window, apparently to the home's basement. The glass of the window had been blacked out, coated on the inside with an opaque paint. Some kind of dark room, maybe? The bluish glow she had seen was emanating through a tiny spot on the window where the black paint had started to peel. She crouched down, trying to peer through, but she couldn't see much through the tiny opening. She tapped on the glass, wondering if maybe someone was working down there.
"Hello?"
she shouted. There was no answer, but as she knocked on the window, the paint chip suddenly detached and fell off, affording her a more complete view. She leaned in, nearly pressing her face to the window as she scanned the basement. Instantly, she wished she hadn't.
"What in the name of God?"
Transfixed, she remained crouched there for a moment, staring in abject horror at the scene before her. Finally, trembling, the guard groped for the radio on her belt. She never found it. A sizzling pair of taser prongs slammed into the back of her neck, and a searing pain shot through her body. Her muscles seized, and she pitched forward, unable even to close her eyes, before her face hit the cold ground. Chapter 61. Tonight was not the first time Warren Bellamy had been blindfolded. Like all of his Masonic brothers, he had worn the ritual hoodwink, during his ascent to the upper echelons of masonry. That, however, had taken place among trusted friends. Tonight was different. These rough-handed men had bound him, placed a bag on his head, and were now marching him through the library stacks. The agents had physically threatened Bellamy and demanded to know the whereabouts of Robert Langdon. Knowing his aging body couldn't take much punishment, Bellamy had told his lie quickly.
"Langdon never came down here with me,"
he had said, gasping for air.
"I told him to go up to the balcony and hide behind the Moses statue, but I don't know where he is now."
The story apparently had been convincing, because two of the agents had run off in pursuit. Now the remaining two agents were marching him in silence through the stacks. Bellamy's only solace was in knowing Langdon and Catherine were whisking the pyramid off to safety. Soon Langdon would be contacted by a man who could offer sanctuary. Trust him. The man Bellamy had called knew a great deal about the Masonic pyramid and the secret it held, the location of a hidden spiral staircase that led down into the earth to the hiding place of potent ancient wisdom buried long ago. Bellamy had finally gotten through to the man as they were escaping the reading room, and he felt confident that his short message would be understood perfectly. Now, as he moved in total darkness, Bellamy pictured the stone pyramid and golden capstone in Langdon's bag. It has been many years since those two pieces were in the same room. Bellamy would never forget that painful night. The first of many for Peter. Bellamy had been asked to come to the Solomon estate in Potomac for Zachary Solomon's 18th birthday. Zachary, despite being a rebellious child, was a Solomon, which meant tonight, following family tradition, he would receive his inheritance. Bellamy was one of Peter's dearest friends and a trusted Masonic brother, and therefore was asked to attend as a witness. But it was not only the transference of money that Bellamy had been asked to witness. There was far more than money at stake tonight. Bellamy had arrived early and waited, as requested, in Peter's private study. The wonderful old room smelled of leather, wood fires, and loose-leaf tea. Warren was seated when Peter led his son Zachary into the room. When the scrawny 18-year-old saw Bellamy, he frowned. "What are you doing here?"
"Bearing witness," Bellamy offered. "Happy birthday, Zachary."
The boy mumbled and looked away.
"Sit down, Zach," Peter said.
Zachary sat in the solitary chair facing his father's huge wooden desk. Solomon bolted the study door. Bellamy took a seat off to one side. Solomon addressed Zachary in a serious tone.
"Do you know why you're here?"
"I think so," Zachary said. Solomon sighed deeply. "I know you and I have not seen eye to eye for quite some time, Zach. I've done my best to be a good father and to prepare you for this moment." Zachary said nothing. "As you know, every Solomon child, upon reaching adulthood, is presented with his or her birthright, a share of the Solomon fortune, which is intended to be a seed for you to nurture, make grow, and use to help nourish mankind." Solomon walked to a vault in the wall, unlocked it, and removed a large black folder. "Son, this portfolio contains everything you need to legally transfer your financial inheritance into your own name." He laid it on the desk. "The aim is that you use this money to build a life of productivity, prosperity, and philanthropy." Zachary reached for the folder.
"Thanks."
"Hold on," his father said, putting his hand on the portfolio. "There's something else I need to explain."
Zachary shot his father a contemptuous look and slumped back down.
"There are aspects of the Solomon inheritance of which you are not yet aware."
His father was staring straight into Zachary's eyes now.
"You are my firstborn, Zachary, which means you're entitled to a choice."
The teenager sat up, looking intrigued.
"It is a choice that may well determine the direction of your future, and so I urge you to ponder it carefully."
"What choice?"
His father took a deep breath.
"It is the choice between wealth or wisdom."
Zachary gave him a blank stare.
"Wealth or wisdom? I don't get it."
Solomon stood, walking again to the vault, where he pulled out a heavy stone pyramid with Masonic symbols carved into it. Peter heaved the stone onto the desk beside the portfolio.
"This pyramid was created long ago and has been entrusted to our family for generations.
A pyramid?
Zachary didn't look very excited. Son, this pyramid is a map. A map that reveals the location of one of humankind's greatest lost treasures. This map was created so that the treasure could one day be rediscovered. Peter's voice swelled now with pride. And tonight, following tradition, I am able to offer it to you, under certain conditions.
Zachary eyed the pyramid suspiciously. What's the treasure? Bellamy could tell that this coarse question was not what Peter had hoped for. Nonetheless, his demeanor remained steady.
Zachary, it's hard to explain without a lot of background. But this treasure, in essence, is something we call the ancient mysteries.
Zachary laughed, apparently thinking his father was joking.
Bellamy could see the melancholy growing now in Peter's eyes. This is very difficult for me to describe, Zach. Traditionally, by the time a Solomon is 18 years of age, he is about to embark on his years of higher education in...
I told you, Zachary fired back. I'm not interested in college.
I don't mean college, his father said, his voice still calm and quiet. I'm talking about the Brotherhood of Freemasonry. I'm talking about an education in the enduring mysteries of human science. If you had plans to join me within their ranks, you would be on the verge of receiving the education necessary to understand the importance of your decision tonight.
Zachary rolled his eyes. Spare me the Masonic lecture again. I know I'm the first Solomon who doesn't want to join, but so what? Don't you get it? I have no interest in playing dress-up with a bunch of old men.
His father was silent for a long time, and Bellamy noticed the fine age lines that had started to appear around Peter's still youthful eyes. Yes, I get it, Peter finally said. Times are different now. I understand that masonry probably appears strange to you, or maybe even boring. But I want you to know, that doorway will always be open for you, should you change your mind.
Don't hold your breath, Zach grumbled.
That's enough, Peter snapped, standing up. I realize life has been a struggle for you, Zachary, but I am not your only guidepost. There are good men waiting for you, men who will welcome you within the Masonic fold and show you your true potential.
Zachary chuckled and glanced over at Bellamy. Is that why you're here, Mr. Bellamy? So you Masons can gang up on me? Bellamy said nothing, instead directing a respectful gaze back at Peter Solomon, a reminder to Zachary of who held the power in this room.
Zachary turned back to his father. Zach, Peter said, we're getting nowhere. So let me just tell you this. Whether or not you comprehend the responsibility being offered to you tonight, it is my family obligation to present it.
He motioned to the pyramid.
It is a rare privilege to guard this pyramid. I urge you to consider this opportunity for a few days before making your decision.
Opportunity? Zachary said. Babysitting a rock?
There are great mysteries in this world, Zach, Peter said with a sigh. Secrets that transcend your wildest imagination. This pyramid protects those secrets. And even more important, there will come a time, probably within your lifetime, when this pyramid will at last be deciphered and its secrets unearthed. It will be a moment of great human transformation, and you have a chance to play a role in that moment. I want you to consider it very carefully. Wealth is commonplace, but wisdom is rare.
He motioned to the portfolio, and then to the pyramid.
I beg you to remember that wealth without wisdom can often end in disaster.
Zachary looked like he thought his father was insane. Whatever you say, Dad, but there's no way I'm giving up my inheritance for this. He gestured to the pyramid. Peter folded his hands before him.
If you choose to accept the responsibility, I will hold your money and the pyramid for you until you have successfully completed your education within the Masons. This will take years, but you will emerge with the maturity to receive both your money and this pyramid, wealth and wisdom. A potent combination.
Zachary shot up. Jesus, Dad, you don't give up, do you? Can't you see that I don't give a damn about the Masons or stone pyramids and ancient mysteries? He reached down and scooped up the black portfolio, waving it in front of his father's face. This is my birthright. The same birthright of the Solomons who came before me. I can't believe you try to trick me out of my inheritance with lame stories about ancient treasure maps.
He tucked the portfolio under his arm and marched past Bellamy to the study's patio door.
Zachary, wait!
His father rushed after him as Zachary stalked out into the night.
Whatever you do, you can never speak of the pyramid you have seen.
Peter Solomon's voice cracked.
Not to anyone, ever!
But Zachary ignored him, disappearing into the night.
Peter Solomon's gray eyes were filled with pain as he returned to his desk and sat heavily in his leather chair. After a long silence, he looked up at Bellamy and forced a sad smile.
That went well.
Bellamy sighed, sharing in Solomon's pain.
Peter, I don't mean to sound insensitive, but do you trust him?
Solomon stared blankly into space.
I mean, Bellamy pressed, not to say anything about the pyramid.
Solomon's face was blank.
I really don't know what to say, Warren. I'm not sure I even know him anymore.
Bellamy rose and walked slowly back and forth before the large desk.
Peter, you have followed your family duty, but now, considering what just happened, I think we need to take precautions. I should return the capstone to you so you can find a new home for it. Someone else should watch over it.
Why? Solomon asked.
If Zachary tells anyone about the pyramid and mentions my being present tonight...
He knows nothing of the capstone, and he's too immature to know the pyramid has any significance. We don't need a new home for it. I'll keep the pyramid in my vault, and you will keep the capstone wherever you keep it, as we always have.
It was 6 years later, on Christmas Day, with the family still healing from Zachary's death, that the enormous man claiming to have killed him in prison broke into the Solomon estate. The intruder had come for the pyramid, but he had taken with him only Isabel Solomon's life. Days later, Peter summoned Bellamy to his office. He locked the door and took the pyramid out of his vault, setting it on the desk between them.
I should have listened to you.
Bellamy knew Peter was racked with guilt over this.
It wouldn't have mattered.
Solomon drew a tired breath.
Did you bring the capstone?
Bellamy pulled a small cube-shaped package from his pocket. The faded brown paper was tied with twine and bore a wax seal of Solomon's ring. Bellamy laid the package on the desk, knowing the two halves of the Masonic pyramid were closer together tonight than they should be.
Find someone else to watch this. Don't tell me who it is.
Solomon nodded.
And I know where you can hide the pyramid, Bellamy said.
He told Solomon about the Capitol building's sub-basement.
There's no place in Washington more secure.
Bellamy recalled Solomon liking the idea right away, because it felt symbolically apt to hide the pyramid in the symbolic heart of our nation.
Typical Solomon, Bellamy had thought.
The idealist, even in a crisis.
Now, 10 years later, as Bellamy was being shoved blindly through the Library of Congress, he knew the crisis tonight was far from over. He also now knew whom Solomon had chosen to guard the capstone, and he prayed to God that Robert Langdon was up to the job.
Chapter 62.
I'm under Second Street. Langdon's eyes remained tightly shut as the conveyor rumbled through the darkness toward the Adams building. He did his best not to picture the tons of earth overhead and the narrow tube through which he was now traveling. He could hear Catherine breathing several yards ahead of him, but so far, she had not uttered a word.
She's in shock.
Langdon was not looking forward to telling her about her brother's severed hand.
You have to, Robert. She needs to know.
Catherine? Langdon finally said, without opening his eyes. Are you okay? A tremulous, disembodied voice replied somewhere up ahead.
Robert, the pyramid you're carrying, it's Peter's, isn't it?
Yes, Langdon replied. A long silence followed.
I think that pyramid is why my mother was murdered.
Langdon was well aware that Isabel Solomon had been murdered 10 years ago, but he didn't know the details, and Peter had never mentioned anything about a pyramid. What are you talking about? Catherine's voice filled with emotion as she recounted the harrowing events of that night, how the tattooed man had broken into their estate.
It was a long time ago, but I'll never forget that he demanded a pyramid. He said he heard about the pyramid in prison, from my nephew Zachary, right before he killed him.
Langdon listened in amazement. The tragedy within the Solomon family was almost beyond belief. Catherine continued, telling Langdon that she had always believed the intruder was killed that night. That is, until this same man had resurfaced today, posing as Peter's psychiatrist and luring Catherine to his home.
He knew private things about my brother, my mother's death, and even my work, she said anxiously. Things he could only have learned from my brother. And so I trusted him. And that's how he got inside the Smithsonian Museum Support Center.
Catherine took a deep breath and told Langdon she was nearly certain the man had destroyed her lab tonight. Langdon listened in utter shock. For several moments, the two of them lay together in silence on the moving conveyor. Langdon knew he had an obligation to share with Catherine the rest of tonight's terrible news. He began slowly, and as gently as he possibly could, he told her how her brother had entrusted him with a small package years earlier, how Langdon had been tricked into bringing this package to Washington tonight, and finally, about her brother's hand having been found in the rotunda of the Capitol building. Catherine's reaction was deafening silence. Langdon could tell she was reeling, and he wished he could reach out and comfort her, but lying end to end in the narrow blackness made it impossible.
"Peter's okay," he whispered. "He's alive, and we'll get him back."
Langdon tried to give her hope.
"Catherine, his captor promised me your brother would be returned alive, as long as I decipher the pyramid for him."
Still, Catherine said nothing. Langdon kept talking. He told her about the stone pyramid, its Masonic cipher, the sealed capstone, and, of course, about Bellamy's claims that this pyramid was, in fact, the Masonic Pyramid of Legend, a map that revealed the hiding place of a long spiral staircase that led deep into the earth, down hundreds of feet to a mystical ancient treasure that had been buried in Washington long ago. Catherine finally spoke, but her voice was flat and emotionless.
"Robert, open your eyes."
"Open my eyes?" Langdon had no desire to have even the slightest glimpse of how cramped this space really was.
"Robert,"
Catherine demanded, urgently now,
"open your eyes, we're here."
Langdon's eyes flew open as his body emerged through an opening similar to the one it had entered at the other end. Catherine was already climbing off the conveyor belt. She lifted his day bag off the belt as Langdon swung his legs over the edge and jumped down onto the tile floor just in time, before the conveyor turned the corner and headed back the way it came. The space around them was a circulation room, much like the one they had come from in the other building. A small sign read, "Adams Building, Circulation Room 3. Langdon felt like he had just emerged from some kind of subterranean birth canal. Born again. He turned immediately to Catherine. "Are you okay?" Her eyes were red, and she had obviously been crying, but she nodded with a resolute stoicism. She picked up Langdon's day bag and carried it across the room without a word, setting it on a cluttered desk. She lit the desk's halogen clamp lamp, unzipped the bag, folded down the sides, and peered inside. The granite pyramid looked almost austere in the clean halogen light. Catherine ran her fingers over the engraved Masonic cipher, and Langdon sensed deep emotion churning within her. Slowly, she reached into the day bag and pulled out the cube-shaped package. She held it under the light, examining it closely. "As you can see," Langdon quietly said, "the wax seal is embossed with Peter's Masonic ring. He said this ring was used to seal the package more than a century ago." Catherine said nothing. "When your brother entrusted the package to me," Langdon told her, "he said it would give me the power to create order out of chaos. I'm not entirely sure what that means, but I've got to assume the capstone reveals something important, because Peter was insistent that it not fall into the wrong hands. Mr. Bellamy just told me the same thing, urging me to hide the pyramid and not let anyone open the package." Catherine turned now, looking angry.
Bellamy told you not to open the package?
Yes. He was adamant. Catherine looked incredulous.
But you said this capstone is the only way we can decipher the pyramid, right?
Probably, yes. Catherine's voice was rising now.
And you said deciphering the pyramid is what you were told to do. It's the only way we can get Peter back, right?
Langdon nodded.
Then, Robert, why wouldn't we open the package and decipher this thing right now?
Langdon didn't know how to respond. Catherine, I had the same exact reaction. And yet Bellamy told me that keeping this pyramid secret intact was more important than anything, including your brother's life. Catherine's pretty features hardened, and she tucked a wisp of hair behind her ears. When she spoke, her voice was resolved.
This stone pyramid, whatever it is, has cost me my entire family. First my nephew Zachary, then my mother, and now my brother. And let's face it, Robert, if you hadn't called tonight to warn me...
Langdon could feel himself trapped between Catherine's logic and Bellamy's steadfast urging.
I may be a scientist, she said, but I also come from a family of well-known masons. Believe me, I've heard all the stories about the Masonic Pyramid and its promise of some great treasure that will enlighten mankind. Honestly, I find it hard to imagine such a thing exists. However, if it does exist, perhaps it's time to unveil it.
Catherine slid a finger beneath the old twine on the package. Langdon jumped. Catherine, no, wait! She paused, but her finger remained beneath the string.
Robert, I'm not going to let my brother die for this. Whatever this capstone says, whatever lost treasures this engraving might reveal, those secrets end tonight.
With that, Catherine yanked defiantly on the twine, and the brittle wax seal exploded. Chapter 63. In a quiet neighborhood just west of Embassy Row in Washington, there exists a medieval-style walled garden whose roses, it is said, spring from 12th-century plants. The garden's Carterock gazebo, known as Shadow House, sits elegantly amid meandering pathways of stones dug from George Washington's private quarry. Tonight the silence of the gardens was broken by a young man who rushed through the wooden gate, shouting as he came. "Hello?" he called out, straining to see in the moonlight. "Are you in here?" The voice that replied was frail, barely audible.
"In the gazebo, just taking some air."
The young man found his withered superior seated on the stone bench beneath a blanket. The hunched old man was tiny, with elfin features. The years had bent him in two and stolen his eyesight, but his soul remained a force to be reckoned with. Catching his breath, the young man told him,
"I just took a call from your friend, Warren Bellamy."
"Oh?" The old man perked up. "About what?"
"He didn't say, but he sounded like he was in a big hurry. He told me he left you a message on your voicemail, which you need to listen to right away."
"That's all," he said.
"Not quite."
The young man paused. "He told me to ask you a question. A very strange question.
He said he needed your response right away."
The old man leaned closer.
"What question?"
As the young man spoke Mr. Bellamy's question, the pall that crossed the old man's face was visible even in the moonlight. Immediately, he threw off his blanket and began struggling to his feet.
"Please, help me inside, right away."
Chapter 64.
No more secrets, thought Catherine Solomon.
On the table in front of her, the wax seal that had been intact for generations now lay in pieces. She finished removing the faded brown paper from her brother's precious package. Beside her, Langdon looked decidedly uneasy. From within the paper, Catherine extracted a small box made of gray stone. Resembling a polished granite cube, the box had no hinges, no latch, and no apparent way inside. It reminded Catherine of a Chinese puzzle box.
"It looks like a solid block," she said,
running her fingers over the edges.
"Are you sure the X-ray showed it was hollow, with a capstone inside?"
"It did," Langdon said,
moving next to Catherine and scrutinizing the mysterious box. He and Catherine peered at the box from different angles, attempting to find a way in.
"Got it,"
Catherine said, as her fingernail located the hidden slit along one of the box's top edges. She set the box down on the desk and then carefully pried open the lid, which rose smoothly, like the top of a fine jewelry box. When the lid fell back, Langdon and Catherine both drew audible breaths. The interior of the box seemed to be glowing. The inside was shining with an almost supernatural effulgence. Catherine had never seen a piece of gold this large, and it took her an instant to realize that the precious metal was simply reflecting the radiance of the desk lamp.
"It's spectacular," she whispered.
Despite being sealed in a dark stone cube for over a century, the capstone had not faded or tarnished in any way.
"Gold resists the entropic laws of decay. That's one of the reasons the ancients considered it magical."
Catherine felt her pulse quicken as she leaned forward, peering down over the small golden point.
"There's an inscription."
Langdon moved closer, their shoulders now touching. His blue eyes flashed with curiosity. He had told Catherine about the ancient Greek practice of creating a symbolon, a code broken into parts, and how this capstone, long separated from the pyramid itself, would hold the key to deciphering the pyramid. Allegedly, this inscription, whatever it said, would bring order from this chaos. Catherine held the little box up to the light and peered straight down over the capstone. Though small, the inscription was perfectly visible, a small bit of elegantly engraved text on the face of one side. Catherine read the six simple words. Then she read them again.
"No," she declared. "That can't be what it says."
Across the street, Director Sato hurried up the long walkway outside the Capitol building toward her rendezvous point on First Street. The update from her field team had been unacceptable. No Langdon, no pyramid, no capstone. Bellamy was in custody, but he was not telling them the truth. At least, not yet.
"I'll make him talk."
She glanced back over her shoulder at one of Washington's newest vistas, the Capitol Dome framed above the new visitor center. The illuminated dome only accentuated the significance of what was truly at stake tonight.
Dangerous times.
Sato was relieved to hear her cell phone ring and see her analyst's ID on the screen.
"Nola,"
Sato answered.
"What have you got?"
Nola Kay gave her the bad news. The X-ray of the capstone's inscription was too faint to read, and the image-enhancing filters had not helped.
"Shit."
Sato chewed at her lip.
"How about the 16-letter grid?"
"I'm still trying," Nola said, "but so far I've found no secondary encryption scheme that's applicable. I've got a computer reshuffling the letters in the grid and looking for anything identifiable. But there are over 20 trillion possibilities."
"Stay on it. Let me know."
Sato hung up, scowling. Her hopes of deciphering the pyramid using only a photograph and X-ray were fading fast.
"I need that pyramid and capstone, and I'm running out of time."
Sato arrived at First Street just as a black Escalade SUV with dark windows roared across the double yellow and skidded to a stop in front of her at their rendezvous point. A lone agent got out.
"Any word yet on Langdon?"
Sato demanded.
"Confidence is high," the man said, emotionless. "Backup just arrived. All library exits are surrounded. We even have air support coming in. We'll flush him with tear gas and he'll have nowhere to run."
"And Bellamy?"
"Tied up in the back seat."
"Good."
Her shoulder was still smarting. The agent handed Sato a plastic Ziploc bag containing cell phone, keys, and wallet. Bellamy's effects.
"Nothing else?"
"No, ma'am. The pyramid and package must still be with Langdon."
"Okay,"
Sato said.
"Bellamy knows plenty he's not telling. I'd like to question him personally."
"Yes, ma'am. To Langley, then?"
Sato took a deep breath and paced a moment beside the SUV. Strict protocols governed the interrogation of U.S. civilians, and questioning Bellamy was highly illegal, unless it was done at Langley on video, with witnesses, attorneys, blah, blah, blah.
"Not Langley,"
she said. trying to think of somewhere closer and more private. The agent said nothing, standing at attention beside the idling SUV, waiting for orders. Sato lit a cigarette, took a long drag, and gazed down at the Ziploc bag of Bellamy's items. His key ring, she had noticed, included an electronic fob adorned with four letters, USBG. Sato knew, of course, which government building this fob accessed. The building was very close and, at this hour, very private. She smiled and pocketed the fob. Perfect. When she told the agent where she wanted to take Bellamy, she expected the man to look surprised. But he simply nodded and opened the passenger door for her, his cold stare revealing nothing. Sato loved professionals. Langdon stood in the basement of the Adams building and stared in disbelief at the elegantly inscribed words on the face of the golden capstone. That's all it says? Beside him, Catherine held the capstone under the light and shook her head.
There's got to be more, she insisted, sounding cheated. This is what my brother has been protecting all these years?
Langdon had to admit he was mystified. According to Peter and Bellamy, this capstone was supposed to help them decipher the stone pyramid. In light of those claims, Langdon had expected something illuminating and helpful. More like obvious and useless. Once again, he read the six words delicately inscribed on the face of the capstone. The secret hides within the order. The secret hides within the order? At first glance, the inscription appeared to be stating the obvious, that the letters on the pyramid were out of order, and that their secret lay in finding their proper sequence. This reading, however, in addition to being self-evident, seemed unlikely for another reason. The words the and order are capitalized, Langdon said. Catherine nodded blankly.
I saw that. The secret hides within the order.
Langdon could think of only one logical implication. The order must be referencing the Masonic order.
I agree, Catherine said. But it's still no help. It tells us nothing.
Langdon had to concur. After all, the entire story of the Masonic pyramid revolved around a secret hidden within the Masonic order.
Robert, didn't my brother tell you this capstone would give you power to see order where others saw only chaos?
He nodded in frustration. For the second time tonight, Robert Langdon was feeling unworthy. Chapter 65. Once Malak had finished dealing with his unexpected visitor, a female security guard from Preferred Security, he fixed the paint on the window through which she had glimpsed his sacred workspace. Now, ascending out of the soft blue haze of the basement, he emerged through a hidden doorway into his living room. Inside he paused, admiring his spectacular painting of the Three Graces and savoring the familiar smells and sounds of his home.
Soon I will be leaving forever.
Malak knew that after tonight he would be unable to return to this place.
After tonight, he thought, smiling, I will have no need for this place.
He wondered if Robert Langdon yet understood the true power of the pyramid, or the importance of the role for which fate had chosen him.
Langdon has yet to call me,
Malak thought, after double-checking for messages on his disposable phone. It was now 10:02 p.m.
He has less than 2 hours.
Malak went upstairs to his Italian marble bathroom and turned on the steam shower to let it heat up. Methodically, he stripped off his clothes, eager to begin his cleansing ritual. He drank 2 glasses of water to calm his starving stomach. Then he walked to the full-length mirror and studied his naked body. His 2 days of fasting had accentuated his musculature, and he could not help but admire that which he had become.
By dawn, I will be so much more.
Chapter 66. We should get out of here, Langdon said to Catherine. It's only a matter of time before they figure out where we are. He hoped Bellamy had managed to escape. Catherine still seemed fixated on the gold capstone, looking incredulous that the inscription was so unhelpful. She had taken the capstone out of the box, examined every side, and was now carefully putting it back in the box.
The secret hides within the order, Langdon thought. Big help.
Langdon found himself wondering now if perhaps Peter had been misinformed about the contents of the box. This pyramid and capstone had been created long before Peter was born, and Peter was simply doing as his forefathers had told him, keeping a secret that was probably as much a mystery to him as it was to Langdon and Catherine.
What did I expect? Langdon wondered.
The more he learned tonight about the legend of the Masonic Pyramid, the less plausible it all seemed.
I'm searching for a hidden spiral staircase covered by a huge stone?
Something told Langdon he was chasing shadows. Nonetheless, deciphering this pyramid seemed his best chance at saving Peter.
Robert, does the year 1514 mean anything to you?
1514?
The question seemed apropos of nothing. Langdon shrugged.
No. Why?
Catherine handed him the stone box.
Look. The box is dated. Have a look under the light.
Langdon took a seat at the desk and studied the cube-shaped box beneath the light. Catherine put a soft hand on his shoulder, leaning in to point out the tiny text she had found carved on the exterior of the box, near the bottom corner of one side.
1514 A.D.,
she said, pointing into the box. Sure enough, the carving depicted the number 1514, followed by an unusual stylization of the letters A and D, where the D was written inside the A.
This date,
Catherine was saying, sounding suddenly hopeful.
Maybe it's the link we're missing.
This dated cube looks a lot like a Masonic cornerstone. So maybe it's pointing to a real cornerstone?
Maybe to a building built in 1514 A.D.?
Langdon barely heard her. 1514 A.D. is not a date. The symbol, with the D inside the A, as any scholar of medieval art would recognize, was a well-known simbature, a symbol used in place of a signature. Many of the early philosophers, artists, and authors signed their work with their own unique symbol or monogram, rather than their name. This practice added a mysterious allure to their work and also protected them from persecution should their writings or artwork be deemed counter-establishment. In the case of this simbature, the letters A.D. did not stand for Anno Domini. They were German for something else entirely. Langdon instantly saw all the pieces fall into place. Within seconds, he was certain he knew exactly how to decipher the pyramid.
Catherine, you did it, he said, packing up. That's all we needed. Let's go. I'll explain on the way.
Catherine looked amazed.
The date 1514 A.D. actually means something to you?
Langdon winked at her and headed for the door.
A.D. isn't a date, Catherine. It's a person.
Chapter 67. West of Embassy Row, all was silent again inside the walled garden with its 12th century roses and Shadow House gazebo. On the other side of an entry road, the young man was helping his hunched superior walk across an expansive lawn.
He's letting me guide him.
Normally, the blind old man refused help, preferring to navigate by memory alone while on the grounds of his sanctuary. Tonight, however, he was apparently in a hurry to get inside and return Warren Bellamy's phone call.
Thank you,
the old man said as they entered the building that held his private study.
I can find my way from here.
Sir, I would be happy to stay and help.
That's all for tonight, he said,
letting go of his helper's arm and shuffling hurriedly off into the darkness.
Good night.
The young man exited the building and walked back across the great lawn to his modest dwelling on the grounds. By the time he entered his flat, he could feel his curiosity gnawing at him. The old man clearly had been upset by the question posed by Mr. Bellamy, and yet the question had seemed strange, almost meaningless.
Is there no help for the widow's son?
In his wildest imagination, he could not guess what this could mean. Puzzled, he went to his computer and typed in a search for this precise phrase. To his great surprise, page after page of references appeared, all citing this exact question. He read the information in wonderment. It seemed Warren Bellamy was not the first person in history to ask this strange question. These same words had been uttered centuries ago by King Solomon as he mourned a murdered friend. The question was allegedly still spoken today by Masons, who used it as a kind of encoded cry for help. Warren Bellamy, it seemed, was sending a distress call to a fellow Mason. Chapter 68. Albrecht Dürer? Catherine was trying to put the pieces together as she hurried with Langdon through the basement of the Adams building. AD stands for Albrecht Dürer? The famous 16th century German engraver and painter was one of her brother's favorite artists, and Catherine was vaguely familiar with his work. Even so, she could not imagine how Dürer would be any help to them in this case. For one thing, he's been dead more than 400 years. Dürer is symbolically perfect, Langdon was saying as they followed the trail of illuminated exit signs. He was the ultimate Renaissance mind, artist, philosopher, alchemist, and a lifelong student of the ancient mysteries. To this day, nobody fully understands the messages hidden in Dürer's art.
That may be true, she said, but how does 1514 Albrecht Dürer explain how to decipher the pyramid?
They reached a locked door, and Langdon used Bellamy's keycard to get through. The number 1514, Langdon said as they hurried up the stairs, is pointing us to a very specific piece of Dürer's work. They came into a huge corridor. Langdon glanced around and then pointed left. This way. They moved quickly again. Albrecht Dürer actually hid the number 1514 in his most mysterious piece of art, Melancholia I, which he completed in the year 1514. It's considered the seminal work of the Northern European Renaissance. Peter had once shown Catherine Melancholia I in an old book on ancient mysticism, but she didn't recall any hidden number 1514. As you may know, Langdon said, sounding excited, Melancholia I depicts mankind's struggle to comprehend the ancient mysteries. The symbolism in Melancholia I is so complex, it makes Leonardo da Vinci look overt. Catherine stopped abruptly and looked at Langdon.
Robert, Melancholia I is here in Washington. It hangs in the National Gallery.
Yes, he said with a smile. And something tells me that's not a coincidence. The gallery is closed at this hour, but I know the curator, and...
Forget it, Robert. I know what happens when you go to museums.
Catherine headed off into a nearby alcove where she saw a desk with a computer. Langdon followed, looking unhappy.
Let's do this the easier way.
It seemed Professor Langdon, the art connoisseur, was having an ethical dilemma about using the internet when an original was so nearby. Catherine stepped behind the desk and powered up the computer. When the machine finally came to life, she realized she had another problem.
There's no icon for a browser.
It's an internal library network. Langdon pointed to an icon on the desktop. Try that. Catherine clicked on the icon marked Digital Collections. The computer accessed a new screen, and Langdon pointed again. Catherine clicked on his choice of icon, Fine Prints Collection. The screen refreshed. Fine Prints. Search. Type in Albrecht Dürer. Catherine entered the name and then clicked the search key. Within seconds, the screen began displaying a series of thumbnail images. All of the images looked to be similar in style. Intricate black and white engravings. Dürer had apparently done dozens of similar engravings. Catherine scanned the alphabetical list of his artwork. Adam and Eve. Betrayal of Christ. Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Great Passion. Last Supper. Seeing all the biblical titles, Catherine recalled that Dürer practiced something called mystic Christianity, a fusion of early Christianity, alchemy, astrology, and science. Science. The image of her lab in flames rushed through her mind. She could barely process the long-term ramifications, but for the moment, her thoughts turned to her assistant Trish.
I hope she made it out.
Langdon was saying something about Dürer's version of the Last Supper, but Catherine was barely listening. She had just seen the link for Melancholia I. She clicked the mouse, and the page refreshed with general information. Melancholia I, 1514. Albrecht Dürer. Engraving on laid paper. Rosenwald Collection, National Gallery of Art, Washington, D.C. When she scrolled down, a high-res digital image of Dürer's masterpiece appeared in all its glory. Catherine stared in bewilderment, having forgotten just how strange it was. Langdon gave an understanding chuckle. As I said, it's cryptic. Melancholia One consisted of a brooding figure with giant wings, seated in front of a stone building, surrounded by the most disparate and bizarre collection of objects imaginable. Measuring scales, an emaciated dog, carpenter's tools, an hourglass, various geometric solids, a hanging bell, a puto, a blade, a ladder. Catherine vaguely recalled her brother telling her that the winged figure was a representation of human genius, a great thinker with chin in hand, looking depressed, still unable to achieve enlightenment. The genius is surrounded with all of the symbols of his human intellect, objects of science, math, philosophy, nature, geometry, even carpentry, and yet is still unable to climb the ladder to true enlightenment. Even the human genius has difficulty comprehending the ancient mysteries. Symbolically, Langdon said, this represents mankind's failed attempt to transform human intellect into godlike power. In alchemical terms, it represents our inability to turn lead into gold.
Not a particularly encouraging message, Catherine agreed. So how does it help us?
She did not see the hidden number 1514 that Langdon was talking about.
Order from chaos, Langdon said, flashing a lopsided grin. Just as your brother promised.
He reached in his pocket and pulled out the grid of letters he had written earlier from the Masonic cipher. Right now, this grid is meaningless. He spread the paper out on the desk. On it was a grid of 16 letters in random order. Catherine eyed the grid.
Definitely meaningless.
But Dürer will transform it.
And how might he do that?
Linguistic alchemy. Langdon motioned to the computer screen. Look carefully. Hidden in this masterpiece is something that will make sense of our 16 letters. He waited. Do you see it yet? Look for the number 1514. Catherine was in no mood to play classroom.
Robert, I see nothing. An orb, a ladder, a knife, a polyhedron, a scale. I give up.
Look. There in the background. Carved into that building behind the angel, beneath the bell. Dürer engraved a square that is full of numbers. Catherine now saw the square that contained numbers, among them 1514. Catherine, that square is the key to deciphering the pyramid. She shot him a surprised look. That's not just any square, Langdon said, grinning. That, Ms. Solomon, is a magic square.
Chapter 69. Where the hell are they taking me?
Bellamy was still blindfolded in the back of an SUV. After a short stop somewhere close to the Library of Congress, the vehicle had continued on, but only for a minute. Now the SUV had stopped again, having again traveled only about a block. Bellamy heard muffled voices talking.
"Sorry, impossible," an authoritative voice was saying. "Closed at this hour."
The man driving the SUV replied with equal authority.
CIA investigation. National security.
Apparently the exchange of words and IDs was persuasive, because the tone shifted immediately.
Yes, of course. Service entrance.
There was the loud grinding of what sounded like a garage door, and as it opened, the voice added,
Shall I accompany you? Once you're inside, you won't be able to get through. No, we have access already.
If the guard was surprised, it was too late. The SUV was moving again. It advanced about 50 yards and then came to a stop. The heavy door rumbled closed again behind them. Silence. Bellamy realized he was trembling. With a bang, the SUV's rear hatch flew open. Bellamy felt a sharp pain in his shoulders as someone dragged him out by his arms, then lifted him to his feet. Without a word, a powerful force led him across a wide expanse of pavement. There was a strange, earthy smell here that he could not place. There were footsteps of someone else walking with them, but whoever it was had yet to speak. They stopped at a door, and Bellamy heard an electronic ping. The door clicked open. Bellamy was manhandled through several corridors, and could not help but notice that the air was warmer and more humid.
An indoor pool, maybe?
No. The smell in the air was not chlorine. It was far more earthy and primal.
Where the hell are we?
Bellamy knew he could not be more than a block or two from the Capitol building. Again they stopped, and again he heard the electronic beep of a security door. This one slid open with a hiss. As they pushed him through, the smell that hit him was unmistakable. Bellamy now realized where they were.
My God.
He came here often, although never through the service entrance. This magnificent glass building was only 300 yards from the Capitol building and was technically part of the Capitol complex.
I run this place.
Bellamy now realized it was his own key fob that was giving them access. Powerful arms pushed him through the doorway, leading him down a familiar winding walkway. The heavy, damp warmth of this place usually felt comforting to him. Tonight, he was sweating.
What are we doing here?
Bellamy was halted suddenly and seated on a bench. The man with the muscles unhooked his handcuffs, only long enough to reaffix them to the bench behind his back.
What do you want from me?
Bellamy demanded, heart pounding wildly. The only response he received was the sound of boots walking off and the glass door sliding shut. Then silence. Dead silence.
They're just going to leave me here?
Bellamy was sweating more heavily now as he struggled to release his hands.
I can't even take off my blindfold?
Help!
He shouted.
Anybody!
Even as he called out in panic, Bellamy knew nobody was going to hear him. This massive glass room, known as the jungle, was entirely airtight when the doors were closed.
They left me in the jungle, he thought. Nobody will find me until morning.
Then he heard it. The sound was barely audible, but it terrified Bellamy like no sound he had ever heard in his life. Something breathing, very close. He was not alone on the bench. The sudden hiss of a sulfur match sizzled so close to his face that he could feel the heat. Bellamy recoiled, instinctively yanking hard at his chains. Then, without warning, a hand was on his face, removing his blindfold. The flame before him reflected in the black eyes of Inoue Sato as she pressed the match against the cigarette dangling from her lips, only inches away from Bellamy's face. She glared at him in the moonlight that filtered down through the glass ceiling. She looked pleased to see his fear.
So, Mr. Bellamy,
Sato said, shaking out the match,
where shall we begin?
Chapter 70. A magic square. Catherine nodded as she eyed the numbered square in Dürer's engraving. Most people would have thought Langdon had lost his mind, but Catherine had quickly realized he was right. The term magic square referred not to something mystical, but to something mathematical. It was the name given to a grid of consecutive numbers arranged in such a way that all the rows, columns, and diagonals added up to the same thing. Created some 4,000 years ago by mathematicians in Egypt and India, magic squares were still believed by some to hold magical powers. Catherine had read that even nowadays devout Indians drew special 3x3 magic squares called the Kubera Kolam on their puja altars. Primarily, though, modern man had relegated magic squares to the category of recreational mathematics. Some people still deriving pleasure from the quest to discover new magical configurations. Sudoku for geniuses. Catherine quickly analyzed Dürer's square, adding up the numbers in several rows and columns.
34, she said. Every direction adds up to 34.
Exactly, Langdon said. But did you know that this magic square is famous because Dürer accomplished the seemingly impossible? He quickly showed Catherine that in addition to making the rows, columns, and diagonals add up to 34, Dürer had also found a way to make the four quadrants, the four center squares, and even the four corner squares
add up to that number. Most amazing, though, was Durer's ability to position the numbers 15